Because he is preoccupied and engrossed and totally focused upon Allah. Here, Imam Ali explains this idea or this concept to us, that we should not let any kind of fear overtake our heart. Yes, the fear of the disobedience of Allah, the fear of not living up to the expectations of Allah, the fear of not being able to satisfy and have Allah be content with us. This kind of fear is good to be preoccupied in. Of course, keeping in mind that fear and hope are the two wings towards prosperity and salvation. And even though we have the fear of disobeying Allah, if we have disobeyed Allah, then we have hope in His forgiveness. With this discussion aside, though, we should remember to not let any kind of physical, materialistic, or the enemies of Allah put fear into our hearts for them. And of course, if the heart is self-satisfied, if it doesn't see any problems with itself, you know, for example, we don't find any fault with us, then we will forget to preserve ourselves, to protect ourselves, to help ourselves grow. So we must always push forward the limits of the obedience to Allah and push forward the love for Allah, and of course never fear anything or anyone except the Almighty Allah. Beautiful, profound lessons brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRab English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم إن قلوب المخبتين إليك والها وسبل الراغبين إليك شارعا وعلى القاصدين.
O Allah, verily the hearts of those who surrender to Thee are full of passionate love. The path of those who long for Thee is the straight, true road. The instructions given by those who lead on Thee are distinct and precise. The minds of those who are aware of Thy reality are filled with awe and reverence. The call of those who invite unto Thee is loud and clear, and the doors of approval are kept open for them. Whoso submits a supplication to Thee receives a favorable answer. Whoso turns repentant unto Thee gets acceptance and amnesty. Whoso bursts into tears in fear of Thy punishment obtains mercy. Whoso seeks redress from Thee finds the required assistance at his disposal. Whoso asks for Thy help, procures the aid as a gift. Thy promise made with Thy servants is fulfilled. Whoso asks for pardon of his errors finds them reduced to nothing. Whoso does everything for Thy sake discovers that each and every deed has been preserved. The means of livelihood available to the created being come from Thee like a rainfall, and in addition, many recurring favors and bounties reach them in regular succession. The sin of those who ask for forgiveness are overlooked. The wants and needs of all that which has been created by Thee are properly satisfied. Those who put forward genuine demands gets more than they ask for, one after the other, again and again. For the hungry, wholesome food is arranged. For the thirsty, clean water is available in abundance.
Now we invite you to listen to Brother Hassanain Rajabali.
You find that they knew every messenger that left this world with as-salah, as-salah. Allahu Akbar. Salah, it's a pillar, very important. Tell me, where in the Quran does Allah mention that Fajr is 2, Dhuhr is 4, Asr is 4, Maghrib is 3, and Isha is 4? Where does it mention? Isn't Hajj another pillar? Huh? Where does Allah mention how many times to go around the Kaaba? There is no ayah in the Quran that tells us how many times to go around the Kaaba. There is no ayah. There is no ayah in the Quran that tells us how many cycles in each prayer. Yet it is the pillar of Islam. Why? Because Allah in the Quran is saying, these things, you will get it from Rasulullah. Your messenger is the one who's going to show you which one it is, what it is. Therefore, the wali, the khalifa, the successor, it can be told by nobody but Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
In the limelight.
The capitals of European countries have been the scene of protests and strikes in recent days. Protesters demand a freeze on spiking energy prices and better pay amid high inflation in the continent. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. According to the website of RT, thousands took to the streets in Brussels recently to demand a freeze on spiking energy prices and better pay amid high inflation in Belgium and the EU. Temperatures in the Belgian capital fell below 0 Celsius on the day, but the rally still attracted more than 16,500 people, according to police. The action was supported by leading trade unions, disrupting public services and transport systems in Brussels and elsewhere across the country. The capital's airport said that some flights had to be cancelled. The unions believe that Belgian authorities should follow the example of neighbouring France and cap energy prices. A joint statement declared that protests will continue until workers' demands are met. Leader of the Workers' Party of Belgium, Herbu Raoul, insisted thousands of people are sending a clear message to the government. Things can go on like this. Gas and electricity prices have surged in Europe as the economic strain caused by COVID-19 was further aggravated by the fallout of EU sanctions on Moscow over the conflict in Ukraine and the subsequent reduction of Russian energy supplies to the bloc. Last month, Belgium's headline inflation figure reached 10.63%, while consumer inflation within the Eurozone as a whole stood at around 10%. Last month, Belgium's headline inflation figure reached that high. Meanwhile, Reuters reported thousands of people protested in Dublin recently, calling on the government to address Ireland's housing and homelessness crises. While the protest has the backing of Irish celebrities, right-wing activists argue the predicament is linked to immigration. The protest was organized by Raise the Roof, a coalition of politicians, trade unions and homelessness charities. The group is demanding that the Irish government build affordable homes, declare a legal right to housing and strengthen tenants' rights. Backed by Ireland's largest opposition parties, Sinn Féin and the Labour Party, and promoted by celebrities, the demonstration came as Ireland faces the combined challenges of record homelessness, huge rent spikes, a dearth of housing, and an unprecedented influx of refugees and asylum seekers. According to RT, the protest organizers called on the government to increase the supply of housing, including by requisitioning vacant properties, though Raise the Roof's manifesto makes no mention of addressing the demand side. Ireland does not have the space for people it is welcoming. Conservative media outlets Grip wrote recently, adding, "We lack the houses and the general infrastructure to support this rate of new arrival. Ireland is in fact full." By the end of the year, Ireland will have taken in more than 70,000 Ukrainian refugees at a cost to the state of $642 million. It is estimated that half of the new arrivals are living in hotels, guest houses and other repurposed buildings. Meanwhile, a record 11,397 Irish people were left homeless last month, according to figures from homelessness charity Focus Ireland. In addition to Ukrainians, Ireland took in nearly 10,000 asylum seekers from other countries in the first 9 months of the year, the highest figure since 2001, with the total number of foreigners admitted in 2022 exceeding the population of Ireland's fourth largest city, Galway. Locals in some areas have protested the new arrivals, most of whom came from Nigeria, Georgia and Somalia. Hundreds of residents of Dublin's East Wall neighbourhood have picketed a former power utility building after the government moved in 380 mostly male migrants last week. Residents say they weren't consulted about the plan, and anti-immigration activists have pressed Integration Minister Roderick O'Gromain on why this wasn't done for homeless Irish citizens. Anti-government protests are typically written off by Ireland's government as the work of a right-wing fringe, with Dublin City Councillor Ray McAdam, a member of Ireland's governing Fine Gael party, describing the East Wall demonstrations as the worst of Donald Trump-type politics.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask this curl? Why does she dress that way? All covered up in a world that gives it all away. Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Din al-Islam, din al-Islam, din al-Islam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about banking in this episode and the upcoming episodes, hopefully, or inshallah, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we start our program, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Maharaj Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Jawad, our guest speaker. We are focusing on the Islamic laws or some of the Islamic laws related to banking and financial matters. Sheikh Jawad, let me ask you this question. You know, some of the banks give you different kinds of loans based on their purposes or the purposes of the recipient of those loans those people who receive the loans, right?
Yes.
And one of them being something like a mortgage, basically, mortgage, right? The housing banks, basically.
Yes.
They grant you the loans to buy, build, refurbish your own property, all right? So having bought the property or refurbished it, right, the bank retrieves the loan from the borrower by installments or in series, basically,
sure.
Right?
Yes.
So you need to pay that like in different kinds of installments, not all at the same time. However, the total sum paid back will usually be larger, right, than
yes.
the one that had been granted in the first instance. Well, is there any legal justification for this kind of payment or the payment of the extra amount over and above the amount of the loan?
Sure. Well, as I understood, the bank, the housing bank or that gives the mortgage
mm-hmm.
Receives an amount extra above, more than the principal amount
yes.
given to the recipient. Or to the debtor.
Uh-huh.
Well, it is Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei states it in a clear-cut manner. He says that it is known, actually, that at least with some banks, that they do not grant money by way of loan, okay?
Uh-huh.
Some banks do not give money by way of loan. To just avoid usury, to avoid riba, because riba is basically forbidden according to Islam. So there are some Muslim banks that do not grant loan based on riba, and there is no such stipulation in the contract signed by both parties.
Right.
So the term riba is not used, and there's no such stipulation made by the banks. In fact, it is the contract which is signed by the two parties is in accordance with some valid and, of course, Shari'i contract. As I said in the previous episode, these Shari'i contract includes like silent partnership or ju'ala or even partnership in itself. And maybe it could be a kind of rent. And there are many, many, you know, halal or shari'i contracts
mm-hmm.
Based on which the agreement is signed.
Yes.
Now, if this is the agreement made and reached by the two parties, of course, there's no objection to receiving the extra amount or in addition to the principal amount because it was based on a shari'i contract. But, of course, just as I said, if let's assume that the housing loan was paid to the debtor
mm-hmm.
as a loan and not as a contract, a Shari'i contract, of course, the transaction itself, according to Supreme Leader, the transaction itself is valid. And of course, there is no objection to the contract
mm-hmm.
itself, the
mm-hmm.
transaction itself. Although receiving money based on loan or on usury is forbidden.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the Library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And Sheikh Tawid, our guest speaker. The topic is banking and financial matters and the Islamic laws pertaining to this particular issue, according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Tawid, you know, some banks, they give you an interest rate of, you know, somewhere between 3% to even 20%
more than.
Or even more than that percent, right? On the any sums of money that you deposit with those banks, all right?
Yes.
As a means of, or in order to circumvent usury or riba, is it possible, is it permissible to treat this increase, all right, this
yes.
interest rate, as a kind of, you know, compensation for the depreciation or devaluing of the purchasing power of the money deposited and, you know, thus allow for the inflation?
Of course, this is what we see on the ground. Of course, some banks charge their customers, let's say, even 20% or, you know, interest, mm-hmm. Saying that the money, for example, the money has lost its original value. So actually the answer is that if the profits have been realized as a result of the investing the deposited money
mm-hmm.
on behalf of the customer according to a valid and Shari contract, then they cannot be treated as riba. The money cannot be treated as usury, okay?
Right.
Because the bank used the money, the customer's money or the depositor's money in some halal project. Okay, the investment was made by the bank, but the money was given by the depositors. So this kind of investment is halal. And because then bank knows where to deposit it and where to invest it. So this investment is actually a kind of joint venture. It is the money is deposited by the person, by the client, and then the investment is made by the bank, and it's kind of a joint venture. So there is no objection in this kind of transaction, and it, of course it cannot be considered riba. Mm-hmm. And there's no doubt also that the profits made from these transactions and this Shari transaction can be received by the depositor.
Mm-hmm.
It is halal.
Sheikh mm-hmm. Sawid, what about the Islamic law or the fatwa of Ayatollah Khamenei about working in the banks that, you know, also cover usury, also include and involve riba and usury. Especially, you know, that in today's world, it's too hard to find a job. So if you can't find any, you know, place actually or a post to land for yourself, is it permissible actually to go and work on those banks?
That's a very important question, and of course one of the most frequently asked questions as far as I know. You know, because a lot of people have this opportunity to work in a bank and of course get a bank job,
mm-hmm.
But they are afraid of getting involved in and usury, which is not permissible. Of course, His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei says that if the work in the bank is in any way related to riba-based transactions, of course, is totally forbidden. It's not permissible under any circumstances. And of course, the claim that there is no job, there's a scarcity of job, mm-hmm. or there is no employment,
yes,
by which to earn a living, of course, is not a valid reason or excuse to engage in a haram business in the bank. So one has to look for a halal job. Of course, halal jobs are there, and that's not a good excuse to say, okay, since there is no job, I can do this job and continue to engage in a haram activity. Of course, that's not a good way to earn your living, because you need to find a halal source of income for yourself and for your family.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Thank you very much, my dear listeners, for listening to the program, Islamic Laws on Arabi English Radio. The topic that we try to touch on was Islamic laws related to banking, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Thank you very much for listening. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hojjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned. In the Holy Quran, Surah An-Nisa, Ayah 32, we read, Do not covet the advantage which Allah has given some of you over others. To men belongs a share of what they have earned, and to women a share of what they have earned. And ask Allah for His bounty. Indeed, Allah has knowledge of all things.
Thank you.
We have so many narrations in Islam emphasizing the point that open relation between opposite genders is forbidden, especially between non-mahrams. In other words, Islam has some etiquettes for the relation between men and women when in party, market, or workplace. The only open and warm relation between men and women accepted by Islam is that of wife and husband. The beauty and body of a wife is only allowed to be shown to a husband and not the stranger man in public. The warm relation between opposite genders in the society establishes cold relation between the spouses inside the house. Chastity and honor of men and women is the best solution for strengthening family bond in the society. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hojjatul Islam Mandegari. To find out more about our program on Call of Islam page, IRIB English Radio, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
In the limelight.
The U.S. Senate has recently passed legislation authorizing a record $858 billion in annual defense spending, $45 billion more than proposed by President Joe Biden. This is while the GOP is blocking $12 billion to fight child poverty. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of Common Dreams wrote in this regard, Congressional Republicans happily teamed up with Democrats this month to authorize $858 billion in military spending for the next fiscal year. But the GOP is refusing to even consider proposals to revive the child tax credit expansion that lifted millions of kids out of poverty last year, even though bringing the program back would cost a fraction of the Pentagon outlay. A spokesperson for Senate Finance Committee Chair Ron Wyden told Huffington Post earlier this week that Republicans have thus far been unwilling to negotiate over the child tax credit, CTC boost, which they unanimously opposed when it was enacted as part of the American Rescue Plan last year. Republicans have refused to engage at all on the child tax credit, said Ashley Shapdale. In fact, they made clear they would not negotiate on any deal that includes the child tax credit, she added. Leading Republicans readily confirmed their refusal to consider the CTC boost as part of an end-of-year tax package. With the 60-vote Senate filibuster intact, Democrats need the support of at least 10 Republicans to revive the expanded CTC in some form. As of right now, there is no support for that on the Republican side. Senator Mike Crapo, the top Republican on the Senate Finance Committee, told HuffPost. Republican Kevin Brady, one of 176 House Republicans who voted in favor of $858 billion National Defense Authorization Act last week, declared that the country frankly doesn't have the time or the money for the partisan, expensive provisions such as the child tax credit. The 2021 program, which expanded the existing CTC to include the poorest families and sent out payments of up to $3,600 per child in monthly increments, spared a historic drop in the obscenely high U.S. child poverty rate before it expired at the end of last year, thanks to Senator Joe Manchin and GOP opposition to extending the benefit. The boosted CTC's expiration has pushed millions of children back into poverty across the U.S. and caused a significant jump in hunger, heightening the sense of urgency among campaigners and many Democratic lawmakers seeking to reinstate the program. The expanded child tax credit reduced child poverty by more than 40%. It cut child hunger by a third, said the Congressional Progressive Caucus. Working-class families need this relief now, and Congress has a chance to bring it back before the end of the year. Progressives will keep fighting to get this done. In an attempt to jumpstart negotiations, Democrats have said they would be willing to entertain a slate of corporate tax cuts that the GOP wants to enact before the end of the year. But even the prospect of delivering another major windfall to large companies hasn't proved sufficiently enticing for Republicans to suspend their long-standing opposition to government anti-poverty programs. Congressional Democrats and the Biden White House have also suggested they would accept a more limited version of the 2021 CTC boost, potentially including more strict work requirements and other eligibility limits, which progressives oppose. Such concessions have apparently failed to sway Republicans. Following the lapse of the expanded program in December 2021, the CTC reverted back to its previous form, which includes smaller payments and a regressive phase-in that prevents the poorest families from obtaining the benefit. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, CBPP, estimates that eliminating the phase-in and allowing low-income families that are ineligible under current law to receive the full CTC benefit would cost roughly $12 billion a year. By comparison, the House and Senate voted this month to increase U.S. military spending by $90 billion over fiscal year 2022 levels. This isn't using our taxpayer dollars wisely. It's robbing programs that we need, like the discontinued child tax credit expansion that cut child poverty by half. Lindsay Kashagarian, director of the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, wrote in a recent blog post, adding, "The only winners here are military contractors who commandeer roughly half of the Pentagon's budget in any given year. Congress has until next week to approve a funding package to avert a government shutdown, meaning time is running out for a last-ditch CTC push." The stakes are massive. As CBPP noted earlier this month, without an expansion of the child tax credit and with the expiration of various other relief measures, child poverty is likely to return to about the same level as it was pre-pandemic, pushing millions of children back into poverty. Policymakers can expand the child tax credit, or they can fail to act and see the rescue plan's historic gains against child poverty evaporate, the think tank warned. Senator Jeff Merkley said recently that he is fighting to get the expanded child tax credit passed before the end of the year. It reduced the child poverty and helped families make ends meet, the senator added, saying, "We must get it done."
Start. Movement. Speed. Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. Islamite. Islamite. Allah my Lord. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Dear listeners, brothers and sisters from all around the world, I hope you're all doing well. This is IRIB English Radio and you are listening to your station. السلام عليكم, my dear brother.
وعليكم السلام ورحمة الله. How are you, Sister Vita?
Thank you very much. I'm doing well. And how are you doing?
Not bad. It's a pleasure to have
Thank
you back
God.
Again here.
So today, as you know, we're going to go through a controversial topic like developing and development, you know, trying. I want to ask you a question. Have you ever tried your best for the sake of your own country or whatever for, I don't know, developing science, developing ethical domain and so on?
Mm-hmm. Well, with regards to my patriotism to my country, that's a mystery. I think it should stay a mystery.
No.
But
to
be honest, I'm more patriotic to my religion than I am to my country, rather. The reason is because I see religion as not necessarily a ritual, but rather a bigger ideology that is adopted not by one country, not by two, but a number of countries. And wherever I go, I find myself in an Islamic country or a Muslim-majority country, I normally feel comfortable than I go to a country that doesn't necessarily have that vibe, Islamic vibe in it. And that is because of my beliefs. And that's why when I see a developed Muslim country, a country that can stand in front of a Western country that is, you know, deemed developed and say that I'm developed, I'm really proud of it. Not necessarily my own country or the country of my birth, but
all
I would really
Islamic
be
countries.
Yeah, generally any Islamic country that does that. I think, and a few countries that really stand out, if we just look in the list, is Turkey and Iran and Indonesia and Malaysia. These countries have done a great job. Yeah, Emirates. They've done a great job. Though, if you look at the political aspect, it's a different story. But if you look at the general development of the country...
Yeah, we're talking generally.
Yeah, so when you look at the science and technology aspect of the countries, yes, they've done a great job. Most of the countries right now, these days, they've developed so much in terms of information technology, at least the field that I'm interested in, I'm really interested in it. And I'm really happy about that.
I do agree with that one. But when you go through the history, you know, from the beginning of Islam, I don't know, 1,400 years ago, it was like, you know, it was a revolution in science, in art, and everything. But after a long time, I mean, right now in modern country, I think there were kind of panic in this kind of revolutionary way of developing, I think. What I wanted tell you is that, unfortunately, I don't know why, but after a long time, the Muslim country is not that much active that it was at the first, beginning of Islam. Let's have your thought after the break, if you do agree with
me.
Perfect,
sure.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Welcome back. This is Youth Station, and we're talking about some Islamic developing countries. Mm-hmm. And I asked a question, whether you think that nowadays we are actually kind of being weak in these kind of domains.
Mm-hmm. You see, if I were to answer from a historical perspective, mm-hmm. We can have a lot of questionable theories here in this.
Yeah.
But if you look at a more general...
Share questionable theories.
Yeah. So, for example, the same question you asked, are we developing in relation to the...
beginning of Islam.
In the beginning of Islam, are we really developing in terms of knowledge or are we not? So the question is actually a very multidimensional question. The point being that there are different areas in which Islam or the Muslims generally from the time of the Noble Prophet, they developed, and there are certain areas that they weren't able to succeed as the Western world. If we look at the way the history works, it's something different. If you look at, for example, from the beginning of Islam, even after so many political instabilities that Islam went through at the beginning and throughout its history, you will find that not a single caliph, not a single ruler, Islamic ruler, or Muslim ruler, I should rather say, or a ruler that would claim to be a Muslim ruler, not a single one existed that didn't give importance to knowledge.
Yeah.
Right. And science and technology actually flourished in Islam when Europe was in dark ages, when Europe was still thinking that, okay, the world is flat. The Muslim geographers had come to the conclusion that the world was round. The earth was round.
Yeah, I know that. And even we have many, we have so famous, I don't know, scientists and poets and everyone that were, you know, they were brilliant in the history of Islam. I don't know if you can count some of them for me.
Oh, yeah, of course, the most renowned personality in the world today as a Muslim scientist would be Avicenna.
Exactly.
He's one of the most respected person in the world. And I think with your medical field, I think
admire him.
Yeah, you really admire him. And me also having some studies in philosophy, man, you'd be surprised as to how this guy, this one person, had so many... arenas of study. Like, he was great in philosophy.
Exactly.
And
after
he was the one
time.
Who kind of, yeah, after he was the one who really kind of reincarnated that philosophy that was lost in Greek after so many changes that happened in the history.
And even in medical field, he was really amazing. Even
he was considered the father of medicine. Everyone,
years after his death, the books and I don't know whatever he published was used around the European countries even. And I think this is a kind of a miracle of Islamic history. And also, but you know, it's not all about history. I think we have to do something about the future.
Exactly. And mind you, the books that you're talking about that were related to Avicenna, many of them were burned by Mongolians when they were conquering.
Yeah, exactly.
So the ones that we have right now, just imagine if we were able to access all the knowledge he had. Mm-hmm. Or let's say some others like Ghazali, for example, or Fakhr Razi. Or let's say, for example, the people, our more recent scholars, like let's say, for example, Allama Tawatabai and these people. These are like, you know, people with great, you know, knowledge of, you know, in different aspects of life.
And let me tell you something. It may be somehow confusing for listeners, even me, that, you know, there are some wicked thinking that, okay, no matter which religion you have, no matter where you are from and so on, it depends on you, how you will develop science, technology, and so on. But I think it is not completely true. You know, from a kind of special perspective, it may be true, but there may be some, I don't know, weak parts of this kind of way of thinking. You know what? I think that when, for example, you are from a special religion or a culture, you have a special mindset too, according to that religion you have. For example, I think Avicenna wouldn't be Avicenna if he wasn't, for example, Muslim. Do you agree with that?
Personally, yeah, I would agree on that. There are many reasons to that. And I think if we go into those reasons, they're going to be very academic. But I can tell you the simplest one is that his upbringing, if you look at the way he was abroad, that really had an effect on exactly why and how he became what he became. And that upbringing was actually a very Islamic upbringing.
I don't want to be someone ambitious or something, but I want to change the history, and I want to make it uprising.
Be ambitious. There is no problem
in
that.
No, I'm not ambitious. It is true. It is the fact. I want to accept that I'm ambitious. You know, but I think we have to do something in this field. Actually, we have developed countries and even Islamic countries among, I don't know, like Emirates, like Qatar and other countries that are so developed, you know, in technology, in, I don't know, science or anything. But I think we need more things to do because we are somehow dependent.
Let's look at it in a more philosophical perspective, right?
Yeah.
Now, Emirates and Qatar and recently Qatar, if you look at the FIFA World Cup and all these Arab countries that we deem them as developed, that development, did it really come from themselves? That's a very important question.
Yeah,
as well.
Exactly. The root
but
of
if
this
you,
development.
Exactly. But if you look at other countries like Indonesia, Malaysia, Iran especially, with all the sanctions that Iran has, and Turkey. Now, if you compare the development between these certain countries, like the Arabian countries, and the non-Arabian countries like Turkey, Afghanistan, Iran, and let's say, for example, Indonesia, Malaysia, I feel a big difference between these two sets of countries.
You are telling me that you know, they are depending on natural sources that they have, like oil, like
exactly.
I don't know
their development is based on their economic development. Their science and technology development is kind of borrowed from somewhere else. If you look at it, like
yeah,
if you look
at
all the computers and everything that they work with, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of borrowed. Their management is actually a Western management. But if you look at, for example, in Iran and in some parts of Turkey and stuff, science and technology that it really originated right there. Universities,
really
nanotechnology
important.
In Iran, it's a birth. It's the birthplace of nanotechnology.
I do agree
was
with
and
that
is in Iran
to
itself.
Some extent, you know what? But even I think in Iran or even Turkey or even every country, even China, you know, they are to some extent dependent on someone. This is a kind of thing that it cannot, you know, this is like an obstacle. You cannot go through that.
Yeah, the dependency.
It is impossible.
Every country, rather, we can say from a very minute perspective, every human being is actually very much affiliated to the other, and they are dependent on each other,
the
no matter how
of
much.
This
exactly.
Dependency is
important. Yeah, and the extent is can be higher and lower. It depends on the country and how independent they are. But generally speaking, the science and technology that is born in Islamic countries is much more honored and accepted and preferred than other countries. And I think there is this gives us an another question, a very important question, and that is, should we really be proud of this, like this science and technology development, that many of the Western countries that have that, as opposed to Islamic countries?
What do you mean that we have to be proud of them? By pride, what do you mean? You know what?
So let's say, for example, God forbid, let's say these Islamic countries, they were not Islamic countries. They were just countries, like secular countries.
So what?
Would it make a big difference in the improvement or the way we look at the science and
no,
technology and their
you
improvement?
Know, there is a beautiful quote that I want to tell you. You know, if, for example, think about it, for example, if American people, you know, went, for example, to a developing country and the people of that developing country came to the American land, vice versa, it wouldn't be that much different because the USA would become to a developing country and that developed country would, for example, become to USA. I don't mean in a good way or bad way. I'm just telling you that they would be the same as their human beings, you know, as the people.
Yeah,
so
I'm not talking about the people itself.
The
I'm talking about the pride that the people would have when it
because
comes to
the
seeing the developments.
You know, I do not agree with that. It doesn't matter where you are. When you are developing science, your nation, your religion, and whatever, it may be affected by them, but it's not the main reason. It's not the tool that you have to be proud of.
In my opinion, how I see it is like this. You see, development in science and technology, and also not only development, but the opposite of it, sometimes destruction, like what happened with Hitler in, let's say, in what do you call it, in Germany, right? Or many other countries, like even the U.S. right now, with the development of science and technology and the military development that they have, and the crimes in the countries, the crimes they've committed in many countries using this science and technology, it's still science and technology and it's developed, right? How I see it is not necessarily the development of science and technology itself that we should take honor in, but the person who is using and who is developing the science and technology, that person, that ideology that is moving forward. Why? Because eventually what happens is that ideology that has that development is the one who is going to portray itself and use that development in the world.
So you're telling me that we have to consider the ethical domains in every aspect
there
of development.
We go. Yeah, that's my point.
I do agree with that. I think we have to try, and we have a long way to go in Islamic countries and wherever.
Definitely.
And we have a long way to go for development in science field. I don't know, every field that you think of. And, you know, besides these, we have to consider the ethical points too.
Yeah.
And this is the most important part because exactly. we're a human being and human being is a social creature.
Exactly, yeah. And once that human being is corrupted, no matter how much development in science and technology that human being might face, will use in the wrong path.
Yeah.
And that
corruption is destruction.
Exactly. That is the tragedy